You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And. Today's podcast is with Maya Payne Smart, who is a writer, parent, educator, and early literacy advocate. Her work has been featured on CBS Mornings, Time, and PBS. She serves as affiliated faculty in educational policy and leadership in the College of Education at Marquette University. And she has a new book, Reading for Our Lives, The Urgency of Early Literacy and the Action Plan to Help Your Child. Enjoy the pod. Maya Smart, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me. Excited to chat.
In the introduction to your book, you lay out a really bad set of statistics. Quote, about 1 in 6 U.S. adults has low literacy skills compared to, for example, 1 in 20 in Japan. That's approximately 36 million U.S. adults who can't compare and contrast written information, make low-level inferences, or locate information within a multi-part document, end quote. But importantly, you also note that the tragedy of low adult literacy has its roots in infancy when everyday early experiences launch lifelong learning trajectories. So this is a huge problem for adults, and the fact is it starts when we're babies. Is that right?
Absolutely. I think it's hard for people to kind of connect the dots between things that are happening with really young children and literacy outcomes that we don't measure until years down the road. So oftentimes we act as if problems start when we start paying attention to them. So when kids are given a fourth grade proficiency test or an eighth grade reading achievement test or as adults in some of these literacy surveys.
So in some ways this explains why we're at where we're at right now.
I absolutely think that it does.
That's and terrible.
There are so many examples, though, in everyday life of problems that really come down to, I think, reading comprehension challenges and people being unable to communicate with one another on many levels. And so while we don't formally begin to teach kids how to read until elementary school, in most cases, there is a foundation of language and knowledge and understanding and brain connections that happens years before we think of it as affecting reading.
Well, and you note in the book that you say, quote, alarms ring, they don't teach, and often when an alarm rings for too long, we tune it out, end quote, which is, I mean, the behavioral science is all over this. It just appears, because it appears too hard, we give up. When in fact, as I read through your book, it doesn't need to be hard. And spoiler alert, a lot of this stuff could be solved by simply paying attention to sort of wise play.
Absolutely. So it's like we make the problem complicated by waiting so long to address the issues when they're really very simple things. Like, you build vocabulary and brain connections just by being responsive with your little one, by paying attention to their eye gaze and where they're pointing and responding to their coos and babbles. So there's sort of this really important groundwork that's laid easily in the beginning. But when we don't build the vocabulary, when we don't optimize their brains for learning, when we don't bring their attention to print when they're 2 and 3, then we expect schools to miraculously teach all of these kids all of these things when they're coming in most cases, at a lower level than is expected for that particular grade level. So the teacher has mission impossible in many cases with 25 to 30 kids who aren't ready for grade level instruction. And that's leaving out the pandemic and learning loss and all these other more recent
things. Yeah. No. Yeah. So that was there even before this. This is not new.
Right. It's just gotten worse.
That's thoroughly depressing. All right. So your parents named you after Maya Angelou, right?
Yes.
And you named your daughter after Zora Neale Hurston. We named our kids Nick and Nora after Dashiell Hammett's characters from the Thin Man Group books. And our kids were Waldorf educated, which you actually reference in the books. And you know, and both my kids' parents, their parents were both writers and storytellers living in a house filled with books. I'll be honest, like, I read your book and I'm like, we didn't necessarily do all of these things, but I think overwhelmingly our privilege allowed us with Waldorf, which teaches later, but you pay for that, right? So we had that situation. And just, I mean, I remember our son Nick had a learning disability, but he listened to books on tape. This is a kid who could tell stories. So, you know, now he's a 27-year-old who doesn't, he walks around with a book. And usually it's one of those books that's like 700 pages. That he's just a reader. So you even indicate for yourself, you felt you made mistakes when you were raising your kid in this area.
Absolutely. I think that I never had that illusion as a parent that I knew what I was doing. I think so many people go into parenting with this overwhelming confidence, and I'm a detail-oriented person, and I had questions. And to me, it seemed like saying, read to your child. It didn't seem like nearly enough when I contrasted that advice with news headlines talking about this terrible reading achievement, particularly among Black students. As a Black mom, I wanted to make sure I was doing everything that I needed to do so my child wasn't a statistic in that sense. We know it's not the kids. We know in all of these cases that the test scores are the result of experiences they've had, lessons they've been given, teacher quality, all of these different factors. And so I really, as a parent, wanted to know the details. What exactly does she need and when? And in many cases, I discovered things, as readers of my book will. Sometimes you just don't know. Sometimes you do a lot of good things on accident.
Yeah.
Right? You're lucky. And, you know, socioeconomic privilege, being educated yourself, being a book lover yourself, there are certain things that you'll pass on to your child. But there are also children of educated, well-off people who struggle with reading. So I think it is really important for everyone to understand all of what goes into it so that more of us can do those things with our own kids, but also share the message with other parents.
I heard someone on a podcast this morning say, it's not your fault you were successful. And I love that. I'm like, oh, I love that. What a generous, lovely way to point out to someone that maybe they didn't hold the key because of their particular genius, you know?
Right.
I also feel like the, you know, just read bedtime stories is the new pull yourself up by your own bootstraps.
Absolutely.
So talk a bit about how ingrained that is culturally, because like when you started talking about that, I'm like, I get this. This feels like the panacea that people talk about all the time.
Absolutely. And I hear it a lot in conversations with teachers around reading instruction, where they say, well, you know, I can tell whose parents have read to them.
Yeah.
When they get in the classroom, as if there's almost nothing they can do once the kids get there to really move the needle, that like so much of it is on the parent. And I was like, well, if that much of the responsibility is on the parent, we have to give the parents a heads up, a memo, a guidebook. But I think one of the most important things I realized in doing the research that led to this book is that when we think about children and learning to read, it's really them learning to recognize in written language things that they would understand if we were saying them to them in a conversation or a story orally, right? So there are two big buckets of things that kids need. They need this big base of just words and knowledge and experiences, which parents provide with and without books in hand. And then there is this mapping of letters to speech sounds, and that, you know, explicit systematic instruction in phonics that we expect schools to deliver at some point. But they need both. And so many kids are really, and you'll see this a lot with parents whose kids struggle, and they say, but we read to them every night, but they're so intelligent. They know all these words. That is wonderful work that you've done to build their vocabulary and knowledge. And that's critical for reading comprehension. But there also has to be some instruction sort of in the alphabetic code. So I hope that the book leaves parents with the message that there are these print-based kind of skills that are important. But then there's also just a ton of knowledge that they get from you, from conversation and storytelling and play and just everyday experiences. And you have to have both to have a skilled fluent reader at some point.
So I want to dig into your six parental levers for literacy, because I think this is in chapter one, and I think it's a very good overview of each of these areas. And we'll get to as much as we can in the whole book. But I really want to, I realized as I was typing my notes that this is very concise in terms of covering that it's not just one thing. So number one is conversation. And what I found, of course, fascinating about this being someone steeped in improvisation, which is that, you know, we know that conversation is, in our world, not just a two-way street, but often a three-way street because it involves the audience and how they're picking up. But what you talk about in this is that it's the back and forth that is crucial, not just the read that thing back to me.
Absolutely. I think parents are often given the advice, if they're told anything about oral language and conversation, it's tell them, narrate your day, talk about the, you know, colors and shapes of the vegetables as you go through the grocery aisle and sort of just talk to the child. But what the research tells us through Lena Foundation in Boulder, Colorado, has created these little devices that measure the language environment of children. They slip into little bibs or pockets in their clothes, and they're counting adult word count. They're counting the words the child is saying. Also with little ones, their coos and babbles, and the technology is sophisticated enough to distinguish between speech or attempts at communication and crying or digestive noises. So, but what that research found is that it wasn't just the adult word count that matters. It's not what you're saying to them. It's that turn taking. It's the back and forth. And very young children, you know, 18 to 24 months old, one study, longitudinal study found, the kids who had the really highest levels of back and forth conversational exchanges with parents and caregivers in that time period, years later, when they were middle schoolers, had larger vocabularies and better ability to express themselves and higher IQs and all of these things. So that was one of the most kind of dramatic illustrations of the talk matters. Yeah. The responsiveness matters.
So I don't know if you know much about improvisation or where it comes from, but the woman who invented all these games that are the sort of building blocks of modern improvisation was named Viola Spolin. She was a social worker working at Jane Addams Hull House on the South Side of Chicago. And her job was to better integrate neighborhood children, immigrant children into her care. So she created all these games, many of which were in gibberish or silence because the kids didn't always share actual language, but that she used these things. And so I'll give you an example. So when our kids were little, our son, Nick, natural storyteller, great. Our daughter, Nora, she did a thing that Nick called Noralogs, where she would just speak forever. So we would do a thing in the car or the dinner table, which is a classic improv game called One Word Story, where we simply tell a story one word at a time. And because you want to win the game, you realize the importance of thes and us inside a conversation, that it's not just platypus, which is great when you get to say that, but that, you know, if you just say that and the story doesn't make any sense. And so that was a really useful tool. And we did other kinds of games like these, and you talk about this in the book, that gamification and that play, we were just playing games we knew that worked for adults and we assumed would work for kids because that's where they came from. But it seems to me like you could draw a distinction between what we were doing there and what you recommend for parents.
There is absolutely power in games and play with children for learning, because the first thing you need for learning is their attention. When we're lecturing or when we're being boring or when we've pulled out a workbook or some flashcards, or we've lost their attention. So we've lost this wonderful opportunity for learning. But if you can get them to kind of like lock in to this shared experience that you're all having that's around language and communication, it's so powerful. And then kids who are playing games like this become more interested in words. They gain a facility sort of with the structure of language and how it flows. Even if they couldn't just diagram the sentence for you, they have that sort of lived familiarity with it that's really powerful. And that's another reason why I think parents are so important. It's so important for parents to think of themselves as teachers, because we just have better opportunities to do it than they do in school, really. It's very hard to capture the attention of a classroom of kids around any topic, but just through everyday life, we have these wonderful opportunities to build their brains and vocabularies.
So number two is book sharing. And I want to point out that you say book sharing, you don't say book reading. So talk about that.
Part of it is because the audience that I had in mind for this book was, I wanted parents to think about reading and literacy with babies even. Mm-hmm. And parents often feel like they have to get through the book. And I've read numerous like comments and essays from parents saying they're skipping pages. They're reading every other, they're tired at the end of the day, but they feel this compulsion to like get through the book. And with a baby, their attention span is short anyway. So you're not winning a prize. You're not capturing their attention by trying to get through this whole thing. But with a baby, they may be learning from chewing on the book, throwing the book, patting the book. There are so many things to be learned through sort of the artifact of a book that reading becomes important. And it's important for the parent to have books around. But I like the idea of just sharing them also, because it makes it feel less like a dramatic reading or a soliloquy and more of an exchange. So like, share the book, let them hold it, let them touch it, let them explore and coo and babble about it.
I remember when our kids were little, we lived in Andersonville in the city, and there's in downtown Andersonville area, there's a bookstore called Women and Children's First. And they had this little teepee in the back with the kids' books, and they had books out that they knew the kids could manhandle, put in their mouths, whatever it was, very pre-COVID behavior. But it was great because there was this sense of like these tactile things that even before they were reading, and we have these kinds of books at home that they could touch and that they, you know, could play with. Some of them made sounds, things like that. And it's like, yeah, they're going to get hopefully to the Odyssey at some point. Do not start with the Odyssey.
Right. You no want, again, their attention, need. Their interest.
So, and that leads me to lever three, which is teaching. And we've kind of covered this, but let's double down on the fact that it's just not just modeling. The fact that Anne and I, my wife and I, read books constantly, and they saw us read books, and we have books in the house, isn't enough. And we discovered this again when we figured out that Nick had some sort of like reading issue, some sort of learning disability. We found other ways to work with language. His spelling was terrible. And so we really, and not like I'm the best speller in the world. And here's my big fear right now, which is so much spelling gets taken care for us. And the podcast that launched today was about entrepreneurship. And because I type up my notes after reading a book, I had to type the word entrepreneurship so much, so many times. I actually know how to spell it now. First time in my life. I'm 58. So talk about that. I think it's like whole child teaching in some regards.
Right. And so teaching, again, for parents, it doesn't have to look like formal school instruction. And also the lessons, those early lessons that it's really important for parents to give kids are very simple. So even parents who themselves aren't the best readers can still impart these lessons. Like, you still know more than your 2 or 3 year old about the alphabet. And it's a powerful lesson, just as you're walking through the neighborhood, to point at the stop sign and say, oh, that's the letter S. It curves this way and that way. And, you know, trace your finger in the air, or have them do the same. Or if there's a menu, have them trace the M and menu and just bring their attention to those lines, dots, and curves. Because we forget as readers that those lines, they're arbitrary. Like, how does a child know the difference between an L or an uppercase I or a lowercase I? It's just, a scribble until we give it meaning by bringing their attention to it, talking about it, and pointing out different instances of it. So it's those kind of simple everyday lessons, and just paying attention to print are really powerful. And so there are numerous studies that show that when kids arrive in kindergarten and sort of traditional kindergarten programs, the kids who know more letters at kindergarten entry, it's correlated. And this, of course, makes perfect sense, that would be correlated with their reading skills down the road. But no one tells parents, you should teach your child the letters, get them to pay attention to the shapes and the sounds. We often sing the alphabet song. Mm-hmm. And what does that teach if we're not also referencing print? We're teaching them letter names, and LMNOP are all blurred together. So I tell parents, sing the song, absolutely. If you're in that habit, they enjoy it. But periodically, sing it while pointing to the letter, so they start to connect those names to something. And then not only emphasizing the names, but saying, you know, this is the sound this letter makes, and make a big deal out of their name. If you write their name on things or label things or have monogram things, and teach those letters. There are only 26 letters. So it's kind of heartbreaking when we look at these studies and say, it's like, this is very doable. We're acting like we have to get every kid to the level of like a Scripps spelling bee winner, where they know, you know, 400,000 obscure words. And we don't have to do that. We just have to teach 26 letters before they get to the point in school where they have to make sense of conversations about those letters. You know, a kid arrives in kindergarten and their teacher is talking about the letter C, and that child who hasn't had a parent point it out or talk about it may think they're talking about C like as in vision, or maybe C as in water, or who knows. So we just have to, we have to give kids a shot. And I think we do that by educating parents about the little simple things they can do that matter.
You know, this is such a thing. I guess it's just us being human beings. We have a very difficult time not thinking things are just this or that. We're so, you know, black and white about these things in the worst way possible. And as you get older, and it's not like things get easier, because they don't. Sorry, they don't. But you actually recognize how complex things are. And if you're in a field like mine, you turn that into comedy because it's hilarious how many times we're getting stuff wrong. But it also, it's such a fierce opportunity to turn up. And kids are so naturally curious that this is an awesome time to tee them up to, you know, one of the things in improv is we make a virtue of mistakes. We say that all obstacles are gifts. You make mistakes work for you because they are. And you talk about this in the book, that if you can teach your kid to take that error and do something with it, oh my God, the gift you are giving them. And this to me ties to connecting, which is the number four lever, because you're not just connecting to them through that, but that gives you opportunity to connect with others, and that whether it's doctors, teachers, librarians, other parents, the community that raises your child. Because by the way, you know, during any given day, you might not have the most time with your child. It's all these other folks who are involved in that too.
Absolutely. I think about my own child. So I'm an only child. I have an only child. My mom's an only child.
Wow.
But so she spent a lot of time talking and around adults. But when I think about other sort of vocabulary and knowledge building experiences, I think of things like, you know, the Montessori school she went to, or her Girl Scout troop, like getting those little, doing those activities to get those badges, and you're, you know, learning about insects, or you're camping, or we forget that language, learning language is so often tied to experience. And so that's why kids who know about a certain topic area, there's one study where it was a study of reading, measuring reading comprehension. And so there were some kids who on other measures were better readers than others. But because the subject matter of this particular test was baseball, kids who played baseball, watched baseball, knew more about baseball, scored higher in their comprehension. So it's important for all of us to think about these experiences and parks and museums and places we take our kids to, and the people they meet there and the conversations that they have are kind of building this web of knowledge that makes everything else sticky.
Yeah. Number five is investing. And I thought this was interesting because you write, quote, "I've never seen spending listed in a magazine roundup of ways parents can boost reading achievement, but it is," end quote. Absolutely. I mean, with actually both kids, in terms of whether it was test scores, you know, for what high school you might go to, or, you know, or whatever, we had tutors, we had other stuff. And again, we had the benefit of, you know, a great deal of privilege to be able to afford that. But I mean, when you're looking at, you know, where you're putting your dollars and your money, that ain't a bad place to put it.
Right. Absolutely. And that is the reality when we see the standardized test scores of different school districts, and they'll, you know, this suburban district is blah, blah, blah. It's not necessarily because the teachers are better. It's because in many cases, the parents prior to the child landing in that classroom or during when they saw an issue, they called in Kumon or Sylvan or whatever mm-hmm. resources they had to bear. So just in communities with more resources in general, it's just compounding all of these advantages. So I'm not advocating for anyone to not pay for their child to have an assessment or tutoring or whatever. Do what you need to do for your child. And also, I think, acknowledge that we all is sort of, I feel like it's too much of a secret, particularly when I was reading about studies, tutoring even before kids have a known issue, just sort of getting them kindergarten ready. So tutoring of preschoolers. So all of those, it's just giving some kids more opportunities to build the knowledge, build the vocabulary. And then they're also going to museums and bookstores and, you know, they're in the TP in the bookstore and
yeah.
all these other things. I think there's real value in just sort of acknowledging that learning to read requires just a number of different inputs. And it's like a fingerprint. It's going to be unique for each of us, but there is value to bolstering the things that are available to everyone. Libraries, school libraries. Many schools I visit and older schools have great libraries facilities. They don't have a librarian anymore because of yeah. funding cuts and different things. So what's a library without a librarian?
Right. So when you talk about investing, then I also think of like time and attention. And one of the things I remember my wife Ann did with our daughter Nora is they would go to the local library. So we had moved into the Lincoln Square area, the Sulzer Library right there. And part of the sort of game that they would play is she'd check out like six books, and then they would go to the little coffee, the Julia Smile coffee shop, which is right next door, and Anne would read one book to her. And then Nora had to read the next one back and forth. They would sort of go back and forth with it. And it was like, look, you know, that was 90 minutes. And I will bet you that 90 minutes was hugely important. And so it's not so much, I think you actually write this in the book, it's not about like spending all your time, but using the time you have to be fully present in the moment with them.
Absolutely. So much of, and this is one of the interesting things, and people have reading is one of the most researched topic area. mm-hmm. So another interesting thing is like studies of the language parents use when they're interacting with kids. And often it's sit down, be quiet, depending on the child's mm-hmm. age and environment. So just having the mindfulness as a parent to think, I'm with my child for X amount of time anyway, and I could not be present and just, you know, try to get the food on the table, do the thing. And of course, we have to give them the bath and get dinner made and, you know, wash the laundry and all of those things. But if we can add just a layer of mindfulness and conversation into it. And then the other piece is technology. Parents, because of phones, parents are not having the same kind of connection, even eye gaze, paying attention to what the child is looking at. So it's not even so much people are worried about the kids' device use, but I think in the earliest years, it's the parents' device use. You're modeling the device use for the little one, but also your attention is on it and not them. So you're not having as much of the back and forth exchanges.
Yeah, this is a big thing for us when the kids were little because, you know, we, in addition to doing live theater, I produced television and worked on films, and my dad was in media, and like, you know, we love movies, all that stuff. And so a very media rich house that then went to Chicago Waldorf School, where they're like, oh, by the way, in the grade school, there's no media. So what we did is our own kind of compromise, which was no media Monday through Friday afternoon. You were good on Friday and Saturday, and then Sunday at noon off. And it was a gift to all of us because it kind of forced us to do other things together. And then I remember because Nick was older, and because my wife is a comedy professor, tenured professor of comedy, so she has to teach
the class.
Yeah, it's a real job. She has to teach, like, you know, classic comedies. So they would do a Sunday classic movie night. So she would, like, with Nick, would watch, like, The Producers or, you know, whatever. And sometimes Nora would come in and watch as well. And so there's also ways of using the media experience as a way to further learn and contextualize so that it's not empty screen time.
Absolutely.
That's it, right? I mean, it's it's richness that you can bring into whatever experience you're sharing with your kid.
Absolutely. And so there, that media presents a wonderful opportunity in the same way that books. So the value of book sharing once kids are old enough to pay attention to the content is you're visiting these other worlds, experiencing these scenarios unfold that don't happen in your everyday life, and all of the words and ideas associated with those things. All of that is true with film, with television shows. And then you add in the layer of watching with them and having conversation around it and them asking questions and, you know, what does that word mean? Or what is, you know, what's happening here? Or, you know, their interpretation, what they would have preferred to see this character do. And so it's not, I think there is a real richness from a language and literacy perspective of media. And I'm a big fan of audiobooks as well.
Yeah.
Because for many little ones who are struggling with the decoding piece of, you know, sounding out words and making sense of print fast enough to enjoy the stories, they can listen to audiobooks that are above their reading comprehension level and still get access to all of those ideas and words. So I think there is a place for it, for sure.
One of my favorite podcasts we did was in the very first season. It was maybe like the 10th podcast, was the guy who ran Chicago Public Library, who from earliest of ages, severe learning disability, he listened to books on tape and he ran a library. And so it was such an interesting conversation in terms of the bias that people had against hearing books or listening to books, which is kind of funny when if you really think back historically and evolutionary, that that's how this stuff's, there was no written book. It was all stories. So his ability and his love of story, which is such an emotional response. And as you point out, like, that's the key. You're going to hook them not through facts. And BJ Fogg, we've had on the podcast as well. So we know about these habits. They're emotionally based. So get them. If you get them hooked on stories, you're giving them a gift for a lifetime.
Absolutely. And we have to let them, we haven't talked about this directly, but also let them read what they want to read.
Yeah.
and value that. I think sometimes as parents, we want them to enjoy what we enjoy. We want them to read, you know, substantive things. But we all, at least as an adult, I read all kinds of things. Mm-hmm. And as a child, I read a lot of R.L. Stine, Fear Street, and other things. But I read all of them. You know, there were a series of them. I got comfortable with the format or the formula of the writing and got into it, and then you move on to other things. So I think we have to be patient also as parents and respecting the things that they're interested in and not judging like the quality necessarily of it and seeing those opportunities for it all to spark conversation and connection.
So in a moment, I'm going to ask you for a yes and story. Before that, let's cover this number six, which is advocacy. Literacy is dangerous for people who are in charge, right? I mean, there are certain people who are in charge who are very invested in people not being able to figure out why they're in charge and what they're doing when they're in charge. And so, and we see this writ large today where, you know, they're taking away funding from all these areas, that give, you know, young people the agency they need to be citizens. I mean, they don't even teach civics in many classrooms anymore. And that was such a crucial part of, you know, when I was growing up. So what can we do to advocate for ourselves, for our kids, to make change, especially right now?
This is exactly why I chose the title of the book, Reading for Our Lives, to kind of emphasize, I want it to be as dramatic as possible, to emphasize the urgency of these issues. So even though I'm talking about things like pointing out an S on a stop sign or letting your child chew on a book, I really wanted to connect those dots that we're not just reading for enjoyment. We're certainly not just reading to get, you know, these test scores or whatever. We really are reading for our lives, our livelihoods, for access to the information we need to secure our safety and well-being and health. And you can see in a lot of the tragedies and things in our news headlines, how reading and reading comprehension is implicated in just a lot of the challenges and things we're experiencing. I saw a public official on the news sort of stumbling through a statement regarding a news incident that's in the headlines now. And I'm thinking the person that's in charge of the emergency response to this is struggling as a reader. How does that affect their management? How does that affect their ability to advocate policies that would prevent tragedies and disasters like this? So there are just so many ways that this is so critically important. So I don't know. I'm trying in every way I can just to again, you know, ring the alarm, but knowing that some people aren't listening anymore. But it's critically important to me. It's obvious that the greater number of people you have who are able to navigate information and communicate well to get policies for the safety and health of their family and community, the better. Like, to me, it's just reading is a public good that we should all be deeply invested in securing for everyone. And it starts when they're babies, and it starts with having these early educational opportunities.
I don't know if you saw this in the news, this maybe a couple of weeks ago, that Travis Kelce was talking about the hardest thing when he was hosting Saturday Night Live was the table read, because he's not a good reader.
Wow.
Right. And I was like, A, good for you, being vulnerable, talking about that. And B, it was just so sad to me, because you're like, you know, he's a very articulate guy. He's hanging with Taylor Swift, who's, you know, wonderful writer, actually, and storyteller. And you're like, part of this also for me is, can everyone just be more honest about the problem, and can people stand up and be like, yeah, I have a hard time reading and you know, and that shouldn't be the case. I think letting our guard down, allowing ourselves to be vulnerable as adults, is one way into this fixing the problem for our babies and our kids. Because it's like, if you're just putting the shield up, that's when you're ignoring the alarm.
Absolutely. It's so critically important. As you're talking, it's making me think about just the power of personal storytelling. And again, that's the most powerful is this oral storytelling of people telling their journeys to becoming the reader that they are, whether that's a great, skilled, motivated, excited reader, or it's a struggling reader who's trying to navigate their documents for their apartment lease, or, you know, this to fill out a job application. But that would be, I think, really powerful, just having people share their reading stories. And when we think about problems, health challenges, there are studies of the connection between illiteracy and low literacy and health outcomes and employment prospects, obviously, and educational outcomes, all these things. There was one study of incarcerated people in part of Texas, and just the incredibly low literacy rates of the inmates. And so it makes sense. If you can't read, if you can't pursue job opportunities and educational opportunities, how are you going to navigate your life? What kind of decisions are you going to make? What kind of neighbor or citizen are you going to be when your opportunities are so severely limited? So we're all kind of implicated in this. We're all negatively affected by the low literacy rates. It's just we haven't articulated it clearly or urgently enough to get everybody to invest in parents, to invest in babies and toddlers, to kind of change this national literacy trajectory.
I just had this conversation with a healthcare professional, because I had to do the sort of yearly stuff for insurance, and I'm on my wife's insurance. And so it's telehealth. They send a thing, they take your blood, all that. And then she was asking me these very pointed questions about whether I take my meds, and I'm on like four different meds. I'm like, yeah, every day. And it dawned on me at that moment. I'm like, I think I actually asked her, I go, do most people not? And she's like, you'd be surprised how many people simply don't take their meds. I'm like, this is the difference between me staying alive and not staying alive. Of course I'm going to. But I have the benefit of understanding what the label says.
Right. The frequency, the dosage, and you can go online and research all the negative consequences of not doing it.
which is all, when there's been a problem with the meds, I've been able to do Dr. Google and then figure out. Yeah. So for those of us who are great readers and we live in families that are great readers, we are taking for granted, you know, and that stat from the beginning, just the millions and millions of people
who, when they're walking down the street, don't know what that sign says? And how does that make you feel? And then how does that make you behave? It makes all the sense in the world why things are difficult when that's the case. And I think the things we have to stop hiding from the problem. I'm curious, very curious now what your yes and story is going to be.
Well, I was thinking of something that was not at all related to our conversation. I'm like, now I need to find something more.
No, close. It could totally not be related. I would love that. Whatever you want to do. Because in improvisation, whatever you do is right.
So phrase the question again for me, how you define a yes and.
So in improvisation, one of the things that we teach everyone is, one of the things you have to get out of for early stage improvisers is being in your fear and shame brain, which is normally when you're in judgment of self or judgment of others. And of those two things, guess what? We're mostly in judgment of self. So we say, here's the gift we're going to give you, which is whatever your partner says, all you have to do is accept the reality of what they said and build upon it. So if they're on Mars, you're on Mars, build from there. Because when you're creating something out of nothing and you just say no, that ends it. And the yes is kind of like, okay, but what am I going to do that? So you yes and, which is really about exploring and heightening the world that you're existing in. And so it's building upon an accepting a shared reality, being without judgment. And so for most of us, we have many situations where it's like, I don't want to do that. No, that's going to be too hard. For so many people, when they answer this, it's like, well, it's writing the book because I made this agreement to write this book. And as you and I both know, because we've written books, not easy.
So kind of simultaneously, two things are now kind of coming to mind. So one thing, like, I'm still in the process of yes anding is my relationship to social media. Because I have this, deep love and affection for books and being immersed in something over hundreds of pages. And yet I understand that many of the people who need the message of this book most are not interested in reading 250 pages about how to talk to your baby, toddler, preschooler about reading. So I'm trying to embrace doing short form videos. And I do not want to do it. I'm currently on my Instagram. I'm on there. It's often like cut down clips of longer form things that I do. Cause I really enjoy, I enjoy long conversations like the one that we've had. They're interesting. They're windy. You can kind of think of something will come to mind from mm-hmm. some area and you'll connect it. And it's just more interesting. So I think I have a kind of longer form meandering personality. And so I am embracing social media in an effort to boil things down to these little tips, little sound bites, even though I think it's a deep, nuanced, complex, weighty, urgent, important issue. So that's one thing. But the other thing, I'll give you two.
Great, I love it.
That simultaneously with writing this book, got serious about writing the book, finished the proposal, got an agent, all of that while we were quarantined during COVID. And that time lived in Austin, Texas. So before the book was published, we moved to Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And I had planned to renovate a home that we purchased there. And then all of these layers of things unfolded about this house that it could not be renovated into my vision, like abandoned, like gas tanks and like all kinds of things, lead, all the things. So I embraced building a new home, and it has been a 4-year journey that is worthy of its own book.
You're very own money, Pip.
when you want to renovate an older home and end up building a new one. So that was the yes and that first came to mind.
Can I pull an Ezra Klein on you and ask for some of your favorite books?
Oh my goodness. So, Their Eyes Were Watching God.
Of course.
So that was one that my daughter was named after. I was in Miami recently and visited a store called Books and Books. Mm-hmm. And while I was there, so this was just over this weekend, picked up a book called Black Liturgies. So I haven't gotten into it deeply, but just love the cover and the vibe. I read a lot of books about mindfulness. Mm-hmm. And so no particular topics are coming. They often have titles like with things like, you know, you're here, be here now type things. I can't think of any. They're all very similar, but this is another theme with me, this idea that of just taking a breath and tuning in to what's around you and sort of the space to choose differently in our interactions with our children or our colleagues or whoever, our podcast host.
That's right.
So I like a lot of mindfulness books by John Kabat-Zinn and others.
There's a really terrific book that just came out by Caroline Fleck, F-L-E-C-K, called Validation. It was quite a moving book for me, but, you know, building off of various therapies, recognizing that across so many therapies and things like hostage negotiation, crisis negotiation, simple validation is the one thing that connects all of those, which is non-judgmentally accepting the other person for where they're at. And making sure they know that. And here, and the book is a very much, here's how you can apply this in your life in many different ways. Oh my God. What a superpower to like for relationships, by the way, and I've been married a long time, but it is like, I could see this was like in a situation where I'm like, I'm thinking in my mind why my wife is wrong about the thing she's saying. Instead of doing that, I simply go, that sucks for you. I'm really sorry. That totally sucks for you. I get it. And it was like, oh, that's a better outcome.
book in a similar vein to that, an older book by Sharon Salzberg, I think is her name, is one called Real Love that has just a lot about how we relate to others and self-compassion and loving kindness meditations.
I love it. The book is called Reading for Our Lives, The Urgency of Early Literacy and the Action Plan to Help Your Child. Maya Smart, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a lovely conversation.
Getting DS And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Emma Smith and Colleen Fahey. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.